Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Conservation Stories. And as you know by now, Conservation Stories is a podcast that's brought to you by the Sandhill Area Research Association. And about once a month now, Todd Ballman and I get together and discuss who knows what. But this time I asked him if he'd bring along a friend, and he brought Katie Lewis with him. And awesome. I'm pretty excited to have you here.
So I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So Todd, you got any updates about what's happening out back there on the old station?
The old research station? actually, I mean, much like the growers, it's been a great year for us. We have been fortunate at all three of our stations. We've missed most of the damaging type weather. Yeah. We had a little bit of pea-sized hail early at the station, but otherwise we haven't been on one of those areas that's had more damage. So that's been good for us, obviously, for our research. The rainfall has definitely helped us. Boy. You know, we're limited irrigation like everybody else at all three of our farms. And so that's definitely been beneficial. And so definitely a lot more excited moving into harvest this year than last year. Yeah. We really feel good about the crop. Got a lot of great research going on. And, you know, and with this kind of weather, it helps with the success of that research as well. Yeah. You know. Sure. Probably surprising everybody, our researchers live some of that weather extremes just like our growers do, because it can impact our results of our research and the effectiveness of that. Yeah. So we're as excited as everybody else.
We've talked about that, like how like research a lot of times is like decades long. Yes.
Absolutely. There's nothing worse than being in your third, fifth year of a research trial and it gets held out and you don't get to get that last year of research.
Exactly. So Katie, give us a little bit of your background. Tell us where you're from and I know where you are now.
Yeah. So I have been involved in farming for as long as I can remember, as long as I've been alive. Grew up in South Texas, Gulf Coast, Southern Gulf Coast region, Corpus Christi. Several generations back, family has been involved in farming. So it's second nature to me.
It's in your blood, it's in your DNA.
Yeah, absolutely. Went to school, got a degree in chemistry. Didn't think I'd be sitting here right now for sure. But took a soil science class and fell in love with it. And so amazing. Went to grad school, studied soil science for a master's and PhD. Met a guy at school that thought he knew he wanted to come back home to Brownfield, Texas and farm. And so here we are 11 years later.
Yep. My old stomping grounds.
Yes.
Brownfield,
exactly.
Texas.
Yeah.
That's great. It's nice to know that people are still there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lots of good cotton that direction too this year.
Yes.
They've been fortunate with rain. Not much of the bad winds or hail that some people have experienced.
Yeah, it's kind of been it's just been a relief, it feels like,
absolutely.
People to have something hopeful this year.
Yes.
Oh, especially after coming off the last 3 years, this was definitely something we needed for all of us to, and not just, definitely our growers, but our gyms, our absolutely. Communities, our businesses, all of them hopefully are going to benefit that. Now, obviously, we wish the price was a little better. Yeah. But.
Oh, my goodness, isn't it bad? We were having that discussion earlier, Delinda Hicklin and I talking today, recording a podcast about how bad the price is.
Absolutely.
It makes no sense.
Well, and the bad thing is that, it's really, and it's one of the few times I remember in my life that it's bad on everything.
Corn's
bad.
There's not a good option.
Beans are bad. Sorghum's bad. I mean, it's just.
Everything. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just looking at like the prediction of like ag income. It's not great, And so, but you still have. That the rain that we've gotten this year is just something that, man, there's not, you can't pay to pump water that does what a good rainfall will do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I know just for people to understand too, that like every time it rains, not only is it's really good for the crop, but that is money saved that a farmer doesn't have to pay for pumping that, and that can get so expensive.
Yeah. And another thing too, I mean, from a soil perspective, we couldn't ask for a better water source than rainfall, leaching salts through the soil, because one of the things with our irrigation water that concerns me is how salty it can be at times. Mm-hmm. and the amount of salt that we're adding to the soil, especially on limited rainfall years.
Yes. Yeah, that's really true. And I mean, I think people probably, most people have a basic understanding, don't put salt on your your ground unless you want to kill it, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And so year after year of, you know, water that's got a little salt in it, that is not good.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
So we needed the rainfall this year, for sure.
Yeah, it's good. Katie, tell us a little bit about your research. You've been around for 11 years.
Yes.
And tell us, have you been focusing on the same thing this whole time?
I would say the general idea, major objective, of course, is to enhance or optimize any inputs into a cropping system. So whether that be, you know, the crops that you're selecting, the fertility that you're adding to the system, trying to optimize the systems to the best of our ability for specifically for the semi-arid high plains. Mm-hmm. We've looked a lot at cover crops, no tillage, reduced tillage. And, you know, someone that came from South Texas, I didn't know what it was like to not rotate crops. So that was a huge thing that I learned coming up to the High Plains for the first time and realizing that things were so much different. And to me, as a soil scientist, I couldn't ask for a better place to work because of all the challenges that our farmers face on a daily basis. And, you know, cover crops being one of those that can be extremely beneficial, a crop rotation, when you combine that with reduced tillage, there's so many benefits as long as the system is being optimized for that given farm, that unit. So we do a lot of cropping system work. We've done quite a bit of fertility management. Most people go straight towards nitrogen and that's what they want to work on. We've tried to adventure out into some different areas. We did quite a bit of work with Cotton Incorporated on potassium management in cotton. That's a big issue that our farmers face. A lot of times our soil tests will indicate that we have adequate and sufficient K in our soil, but yet we'll still see deficiency symptomology later in the growing season and see responses in soils that our soil tests wouldn't indicate. And so we've done quite a bit of work on that. Here recently, we have started moving into more of the biological realm.
very popular now.
Absolutely. So many of the companies that we interact with, industry companies, are looking more into not necessarily completely replacing synthetics, but putting synthetic fertilizers out with a biological. And trying to reduce the amount of inorganic fertilizer we're adding. So that's been a big topic here lately. We just received some funding to conduct a project here on the High Plains. We're working with a group out of Virginia Tech, as well Auburn University. Okay. So really exciting.
Yeah. And that's the nice thing about, right, the land grant universities is the collaboration you can have across states.
Absolutely.
So
I mean, that's a huge advantage to the system. Is one, it opens you up to basically investigate anything you feel is important or that our producers feel is as important. You have that freedom to do that, and then to interact with the other scientists that do that same type of thing, or even bring a new idea or a new area. You know, there's we may not have that expertise here,
but
then having that expertise, if it's not within the A&M system, even one of the other land grant systems that can help us answer some of those questions.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I know that I've never seen it, but I know that there's a farm in Dawson County. Tell us about that research farm, and because it's been there for a long time, right?
38 years,
I believe. That's what I was thinking.
1990s.
So
that was actually one of the research trial that was on that farm and still is there, was one of the first things I started working on when I started in September of 2014. And it's a long-term no-till cover crop system comparing to more of the traditional conventional tillage continuous cotton system. So we have studied just about anything you can think of on that trial. When Wayne Keeling and Kevin Bronson initiated it in 1998, it was focused more on glyphosates, I guess that's right around the time that Roundup Ready Cotton came out. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking at it more from that perspective, but managed it until we took it over in 2014. And we've looked at organic carbon changes, microbial populations.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we've studied some really cool things in that study and still maintaining it. In addition to that, we do a lot of cropping systems work there, looking at not just cover crops, but rotations with wheat. I think there's been some sorghum work that was done there as well. We recently initiated a cotton sorghum and cotton wheat rotation in a dryland setting. Because we all know that's very important.
Yes, it is.
So we initiated that this last year with hopes that it can be there until... Mm-hmm. Past the point of my retirement is the hopes.
Yeah, that I mean that's a really neat system. It, La Mesa Cotton Growers approached Texas A&M, I guess, in the 90s about, you know, because we had two stations at that time here in Lubbock and one at Halfway. Both of those are on heavier textured soils. Right. And they were like, you know, if we were willing to invest in and come up with a location, we'd really like to have y'all looking at a more sandier soil system. And so they put that together and have been in partners with us for a number of years.
That's amazing.
And so it was developed to address questions that could directly impact those producers in that area. Yeah. And I think it's held true to that initial system. This past year, we actually purchased that farm from them.
Oh, really?
We were fortunate enough that AgriLife Research at College Station helped us with the funding to be able to purchase that farm. So we now own the farm, but our plans are to continue, you know, the ideals that it was set up on to make sure that, that we're addressing questions that help that region.
Yeah. And there's so many different disciplines that are working there too. So we have pathologists, entomologists, weed scientists. And so that to me is the exciting part of having a farm and having an opportunity like that is, you know, we can have systems-based trials where we're looking at every aspect of a production system.
So rolling back to the beginning of the subject, you used a word, something-ologist, that I have never heard before.
Entomologist?
No.
Pathologist.
A pathologist. Yes. Okay. Okay. So they're studying pathogens.
Yes. So we have both a research and extension pathologist here in Lubbock.
Okay.
Terry Wheeler and Marina Rondon. And they study diseases as well as nematodes. Lots
nematodes.
Of experience. Yes.
Big problem. Yes. Big problem in the 90s. So tell us what a nematode is.
Can I pass?
In layman's turn. Like, so, explain it to me, the third grader.
Yeah. So
it's a little critter.
Yeah. A little critter in the soil. It's not necessarily disease, but it can be pathogenic. There can also be beneficial nematodes.
Right.
So they can play an important role in decomposing organic material that's added to the soil. But the ones, the bad guys that are in the soil, they can be extremely detrimental to a cotton plant.
Yes.
There are some seed treatments. I guess there's technology now. We have some varieties that are more resistant to the nematode. And we have two kinds of nematodes on the high plains, reniform and root knot.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is really what pushed us into peanut production. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And so that was kind of the first line of defense, try to figure something out, but which was good because it also then created another cash crop for diversification, you know, and then you had, it brought in more infrastructure for something different.
Absolutely.
And so it's, you know, there's a lot more benefits of diversification, just what happens on the farm.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And to me, that's one of the challenges that we face on the high plains is the lack of the infrastructure for farmers to be able to diversify.
This is true. And in fact, I was at an event a few weeks ago and someone approached me about, you have any farmers that, you know, I could contract to grow a certain crop. And I was like, you know, called Lacey and she's like, oh, I can grow it. I just don't have where to take it. There's nowhere to take it.
Exactly.
And so things that could, you know, and I know you probably guys are probably aware that our TAFA, our Texas Ag Fund, has been beefed up. And I think that's part of the part of the hope is that money can be spent in investing
that's
infrastructure for, you know, for some things.
Yeah, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. It would be.
No, that's a definite struggle, and it was something definitely different. As Katie kind of mentioned, from, I grew up Southwest Oklahoma and then mm-hmm. worked in North Texas for a lot of years. And, you know, obviously there's an elevator in almost every mm-hmm. community, the size of it varying, obviously, mm-hmm. based on that community. But there's at least some local source. And then, you know, growing up, there was always a huge commercial combine crews that would come in, especially during wheat harvest that you don't see out here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a grower didn't even mm-hmm. necessarily have to own a combine mm-hmm. to be able to produce mm-hmm. a grain crop mm-hmm. Because, you know, even if he didn't, you know, one of his neighbors would have a custom uh-huh. cutter that he could get in line with and help cut his crop. So yeah, that definitely mm-hmm. is one thing that we really struggle with out here.
What do you think? I mean, is it because of, I mean, obviously this was like the last place in the United States to be settled. Mm-hmm. And I heard someone say they called it a manless land for a landless man. That's what they call trying to recruit people to come out here, you know? So I don't know, is it because of, you know, like think about in the 50s when they really started using irrigation and things like that, we were still just growing cotton. So what is it because of our climate? I mean, it is very good for cotton. It is a great cotton climate.
Absolutely.
It is. But like, are there just really so few other crops that it is good for?
Well, I think cotton is definitely better adapted mm-hmm. to the environment and in this area. But also, I think twofold: one, the infrastructure, mm-hmm. you know, when you think about it, it is a design limited infrastructure.
Yes,
you know, you can't run, you know, like if you take an elevator, you can run any type of grain through an elevator.
That's right.
So if a grower swaps, say, from wheat to corn, that elevator can still handle that.
Yeah.
Where a cotton gin
is a one and done.
And the same thing with a cotton stripper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't harvest grain with a cotton stripper. And so when you make that kind of investment in that system, you know, that somewhat limits mm-hmm. you. And then I would say probably, you know, I know some people would argue with me now, but it was by far the most profitable.
Oh, absolutely.
For a number of years.
Yeah. Yes. You know. That's absolutely the truth. It was the cash crop for sure.
And so you could make a lot more on an acre mm-hmm. of cotton mm-hmm. than you could on an acre of wheat or corn or whatever in this mm-hmm. region. So I think those combined kind of lent mm-hmm. itself to that this monoculture philosophy. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to maybe be as big a case now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so in the position that we're in now, like as we're being pushed towards other things, especially maybe even cattle production, as we're mm-hmm. looking at going back to grass in a lot of these places, you know, I'm curious what that kind of infrastructure is going to look like, you know, as we're doing that, you know. Or are you talking about we need to put in more feedlots, we're going to put in more, you know, like there's not, you know, the cattle sale barn here in Lubbock is closed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of the things that we would depend on as that industry grows, that infrastructure, although don't think it's quite as expensive as putting in
elevators.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, but I wonder too, you know, like we were talking about cotton, you mentioned it's really well adapted to this area. And a lot of that's because that's where we invested the money in developing that, you know, and so many of our, like my ancestors came from the South and cotton is what they knew.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and I think cotton too, I've heard my husband say this before. It's just, we talked about it being well adapted, but it can withstand drought stress.
It's so much
better than a lot of other crops.
Which is so fundamentally different than what you hear people, why cotton is like the stepchild of the commodity world right now. It gets so much bad press.
Yeah.
And I don't understand, like, you know, when I think about how much pesticides we use now based on what it was growing up, it's like nothing.
Yeah.
And when people used to say, oh, hemp uses half the water of cotton, I'm like, that is, I don't know how much water hemp necessarily uses. And I don't think anybody else does either, mm-hmm. maybe at that point. Anyway, they didn't. But I know for sure that cotton is not it is not utilizing that much water here, or we would not be growing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It can definitely withstand some pretty serious prolonged periods of moisture stress.
It's a tough plant.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it's in the family of hibiscus and okra, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So I have a beautiful hibiscus in my backyard that's an A&M variety.
Is it the winter hardy one?
Oh, yes.
That came out of our Vernon Research Center.
It's it is like the blooms are like this.
Yeah, and they're gorgeous.
It's amazing. And I love to look at it because it does so much reminds me of what a cotton plant looks like when it's flowering, you know, like right before it starts to turn.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. It's beautiful. So what are you, you mentioned a while ago, Katie, like different systems being utilized within their specific production region or area or for that certain crop. And that's something you're hearing that more now, like that people are going, oh, we want people to do region. Well, you know, and people that don't know might be like, and it's going to be like this, but people that do know, and you hear this more often is it's going to look different everywhere.
Yeah.
And that it's just something, a point you made a while ago, Todd, was like the soil that's there in Abernathy, the soil that's there in Halfway is different from very different because I know we farm in both places. So it's very different. And so, but it's the same region, but our soil is varying.
Absolutely.
Which means that what, you know, we've had this conversation on our podcast before about what the Binghams can do outside of Meadow, Texas is different than what the Vardamans might do here in Slayton.
So good example. Peanuts do really well in sandy soil, need to be in a sandy soil. Corn, not a good idea necessarily.
Yes. And part of that, right? I mean, like corn needs a lot of water and sand does not like to hold water.
No, exactly.
Yeah, we grew some corn, I remember, in Terry County when I was young. And I can remember my grandfather saying the way you knew you'd had enough water for corn as you tied a goldfish to it and kept the goldfish alive.
Yeah. I've heard that too.
Definitely, yes.
But so when we moved north, of course, there was still water when we moved to Durham in 2003. Mm-hmm. And my goodness, there was so much corn everywhere you looked, there was corn, you know. Yeah. But the soil was just different there. Now, we were growing some peanuts there too, so there was enough sand in that soil to do both, but you know, definitely not so much you can grow corn.
Yeah. Certain soils are just more suited for certain crops. And
And different types of systems. So are you seeing any benefits to, like, say, animal integration? Are y'all doing any of that testing?
Yeah. So we have a project. We're working with cactus feeders up in the Stratford, Texeline area. We have some on-farm locations where we're looking at perennial grazing systems. We've also started some cotton forage sorghum rotation
where
we're incorporating cover crops. So definitely moving into the animal integration component. Haven't convinced Todd yet to let us graze cows on any of our research farms, but our collaborators that we have in Vernon as part of another project focused on regenerative agriculture. It was funded in 2021, so we're coming up on the fifth year of that. Mm-hmm. But they have managed to incorporate forages into their cotton production systems, and they've been grazing those.
Okay.
Yeah, we started in a really tough time with the drought we've had for the last several years, but we've finally gotten to the point where we're starting to collect and see some good data.
Well, it's tough, but it's like it's just reality.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. I know. It's useful data. Yes, absolutely.
So do you think that as this land goes back more and more and more to grassland, do you think it could possibly increase our rain? Like, there should be so much more.
That's beyond me.
I wonder about that.
Yeah,
though.
No, like, it's a good question.
It's never not been. I mean, millennial ago, it was, you know, obviously different. We know from research and stuff, but I've wondered about that. I wonder if it would impact some of our rain system. I don't know. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah.
I just thought you'd be so smart. You can't.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it'll necessarily do that. I think it will allow us to be more efficient with the water sources we have. We may even be able to bring in some other water sources that are more adapted to certain forages that necessarily wouldn't work with what we're having now.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. And to me, the way I look at it is cotton will still be king in this region, but what it will allow our producers is to give them another level of risk management that they currently may not have if they're, mm-hmm. say, 100% mm-hmm. cotton. You know, having that cattle component mm-hmm. or that forage component,
right.
that'll be another mm-hmm. commodity.
Yes,
You know, and right. just like right now, and you know, cattle prices are obviously the one commodity that is in the mm-hmm. positive compared to everything else. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is that a lot of people don't think about, and I've talked to some producers that are friends of mine, is Todd, cattle are high. And I'm making money on cattle, but I've got more money in these cattle than I've ever had. Mm. So it's not like it's not like there's this big giant gap and I'm just mm-hmm. killing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, don't get me wrong. I'm making money, but every time I buy a calf, a whole bunch of money.
Yes. Yeah. It is amazing how much calves cost right now, you know, just to buy one to feed out.
Yes.
It is shocking.
Yeah.
But that level of risk management, you know, and like I said, growing up in Southwest Oklahoma and working mm-hmm. in the rolling plains of Texas for a number of years, you know, that's been a traditional risk management tool that we use. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we can take advantage mm-hmm. of up here as well.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I've seen that play out, you know, with Lacey, you know, Vardaman's mm-hmm. to see like, hey, I don't have enough. It's too dry here on the ranch. I really need some, you know what I mean, something for these cows to eat and then take advantage of that wheat that they're putting in the winter.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is, and then the cows are, you know, they're leaving the manure on the ground. So now mm-hmm. we don't have to do, you know, synthetic fertilizers. And so, I mean, I can see, but it is definitely, you know, we're kind of changing and going back. It feels like to me, in a lot of ways, in management style and thinking about things, we're going backwards in time, you know, and maybe even like to think about the 40s where, you know, probably that's where the height of maybe animal integration here, you mm-hmm. know, because I know that my granddad was a big deal in the 50s when he was integrating pigs and things like that on his land, you know, and that was in the 50s. So, you know, I guess it's pretty much stopped by then.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an interesting time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Katie, cover crops and no-till, strip-till, minimum till, all of these things are kind of a romantic idea of, right, you know, of, I think a lot of people maybe would see it as silver bullet, this is why things aren't working, or et cetera, you know.
Yeah, so interesting, we had a group of insurance agents, adjusters out at the research center yesterday, a big group, 160.
Wow.
It was huge. But a lot of those guys are also farmers mm-hmm. Or landowners. And so they had a lot of interesting comments related to cover crops and reduced till and no-till. And, you know, by the end of our conversation, it really is, you know, unless you're, again, I'm going to say it, optimizing the system, mm-hmm. it may not work that first year that you try it.
Yes.
And so, you know, going out, trying different things, I think is something that we need to try to encourage. And we have a project right now that's funded through NRCS, and it's focused on on-farm research, where we have a large amount of money that we can assist farmers with adopting some of those practices, trying to reduce the risk that's associated with it. Because I think that's a big part of it, you know, mm-hmm. having a husband that farms and knowing how tight mm-hmm. budgets can be, you know,
you might have a bank that goes no.
Yes, exactly. uh-huh. Yeah, your banker might tell you no.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or you may have a landowner.
That's
a landlord that says,
very true.
I
too.
Mean, no, I want you to grow cotton after cotton after cotton because that's how I make money.
Yes. Absolutely.
There's a lot more to it than just why don't you do it.
Yeah. And so, you know, even if we talk about the actual production part of it, I mean, you're right. There's so many different aspects that go into it that have to be accounted for and thought about. It's not just as simple as I'm going to do this and it's going to work perfectly. I do believe that in the right environment, you know, selecting the right cover crop, the right seeding rates, termination timings, optimizing your nutrient management following the cover crop, as well as your irrigation. I think it can be a very successful practice.
Yeah.
Across the high plains, but it has to be managed in a way that you're going to maintain yields in that system.
Yeah. And that's, I think that is, that's where I think like, it's just so different than, you know, what we've been able to do since say the 90s.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just really, you know, and I think about how that it changed, you know, as, you know, I was getting married and moving into, you know, seeing what we're, my dad was doing on his farm and then doing it on our farm. It's just really interesting remembering what it was like to see my granddad on the farm versus my dad versus me and my spouse. You know, it's just, it was very different. And
And so my husband and I, when we moved up here in 2014, the majority of all the acres that him and his family were farming were more conventional tillage, continuous cotton, winter fallow. And slowly but surely, Clay has started, that's my husband, Clay has started adopting some of these practices because he's realized that from a time perspective, it's hard to find help a lot of times. And so it might be him and one other person. And it's just not possible to go out and sand fight and control the sand from blowing. And so a cover crop is the answer. Keeping the ground covered during the winter, at least on his irrigated acres, he's made that full movement towards reduced tillage and cover crops.
He would love
to be able to rotate, but the elevator, the infrastructure component is what's the biggest challenge.
Yeah. And I, like, that's, I think something that, you know, is important for us to be thinking about in terms of economics. I wonder how often investment in different types of infrastructure is, as we think about in terms of a different crop. Could, what would it look like if, you know, a rural community said, we're going to do something that would incentivize someone to come in here to take rye or barley or something, you know, something else, you know? So, and I know, I mean, I've seen it before, you know, I've seen that they're trying to do and bring expanding, you know, diversifying other things. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. So it's a, it is, it's a big risk for people to take.
And I even think, you know, with us, the talk about converting some of our acres back to grass, that's going to be a risky move too. I mean, they're going away from what they've known and what they've done for the last several decades.
And not many people are cowmen and farmers. If you've ever seen the musical Oklahoma, you know that this is true.
Absolutely. My husband is not a cowboy at all. He is a farmer.
Well, I know. I kind of think our first like experience of animal integration when we lived in Earth and we hired somebody to bring in cattle, you know, because it was way more common there, you know, it was just something that we were seeing. And that was kind of my first experience of seeing that, but we didn't ever handle them, you know, because someone else was doing that. And it was a good thing for us and for them. It's kind of like custom harvesting or whatever. It's, you know, giving them another place to go and giving us another source of income.
No, and that, and you brought up, and that's one of the things we've discussed is, you know, there's opportunities to be involved in animal agriculture without owning the animals. And in some cases, depending upon the situation, even having to deal with the animals. You know, I know one of the farms I worked on, the gentleman that handled that, basically he was the cow guy on the farm. He basically leased the land, put up the electric fence, and then managed them from a health standpoint. So basically the grower I worked for essentially had little or no you know, interaction other than having the forage portion for that grower. With that being said, I know one of the growers, he was talking about, had done that several years ago and how he felt that was a disaster on his farm. And I do think that is something to worry about.
It's all about management.
Is who you get in partnership is also key.
It is.
To how that really works and how that success, because I grew up hearing about disasters, you know, cattle dying and not being taken care of like they needed to. From a sickness standpoint, or a bloat standpoint, so there are a lot of things that go into that situation that makes it difficult. And then, like I said, accepting that risk. But I think it also again brings us some advantages against risk, just like it is accepting some risk also that you have to weigh out.
You guys will probably get this. I'm not sure people that didn't grow up on the farm will understand, but you know, you often give your farms a name.
Mm-hmm.
Like my husband's family had a booger and a son of booger. Well, when we moved to Earth, we had a quarter section that they'd been sheep on, and we called it the Dead Sheep Farm.
Oh,
because
yeah,
there were so many sheep carcasses on that farm when we took over, you know, and which I know that the saying about sheep is they're bored looking for a place to die. So I'm not saying somebody mismanaged them, because that's all I know about sheep, right?
Yeah.
You know, but I, when you said that, that's what it made me think of was like, yeah, there's a lot goes into, you know, you're really, essentially you got two businesses going. Yeah, so it's definitely something that changes up your management, for sure.
Well, and I think anytime you make change, there's a level of management that comes with that, whether that's no-till,
that's
cover crop, cattle, forages, or whatever, that definitely has to come with that change.
Are y'all looking at economics when you do all this research?
Absolutely. Biggest part of it, right?
Right.
Not the biggest part. I won't
it
say
is
that.
Huge.
It's huge, though. Yeah,
it is huge.
So we have some economists that are at the research center that conduct the economic analysis for us, and they do more of your basic budget type analysis, but then they also look at things in the future. How is this going to impact the farmer 20 years from now, or even communities 20 years from now? So they can really do some cool stuff with numbers.
I think that to me is one of the most interesting parts of agriculture that I never really thought about. I mean, I thought about our bank account, but I never really thought about, you know, the impact across ecosystem of the rural economy. For sure. So tell me, you used my favorite word a while ago. So it's a good day for me when I'm podcast and I hear the word microbe twice. that was my word of the year 1 year, because I'm a weirdo. So of course, you know, Sarah Burnett, she's the one that made me introduce me to this whole world of the millions and billions, and we don't even know how many
organisms.
Organisms that
more microbial cells on our body than we have of our own cells. Did you know that?
No.
Yes.
That is another fact.
Yeah.
I know that, like, in a teaspoon of dirt.
Yeah. Soil. Soil.
I'm sorry.
Soil.
Like soil. Because in a teaspoon of dirt, there's probably not very many microbes.
No.
That's the stuff under your nails.
Yeah. Or you sweep up off the floor. Yes.
There's way. Way.
Microorganisms are very important in our soil. So, you know, soil health has been a big push. For the last 10 years, I think 2015 was the world of soil, or soil, they celebrated soil around the world. And so that was really the year that NRCS started pushing soil health and the term soil health. And with that came a big focus on the microorganisms in the soil and what functions they were providing to the overall health. And being a chemist, I do have a special place in my heart for that too, but it takes all parts. It takes the physical aspects, the chemical, and the biological to make a highly functioning soil. So we've been working with MyLand. AgriLife has a very close working relationship with them. In addition to our research trials that we have across the state, we're also collecting data from on-farm locations, where they've installed mm-hmm. algae systems.
Yes, and I've seen it.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. a very cool technology where myelin comes out, they collect the soil sample from your farm, then they culture the algae, they grow it up on the edge of the field, and then they pump it back through your irrigation system.
So now they're harvesting things out of your own soil,
yes,
right? That's
absolutely.
What I understand.
Yes, yeah. It's coming from your soil. So it's the native algae. We conducted research with them for the last 2 years. Moving forward, a lot of our focus is going to be on not just what the benefits are to the plant and to the soil, but also how are we changing the microbial community? You know, are the algae proliferating? If so, how is that affecting the other dynamics in the soil?
And it'd be interesting too to see like how it's impacting the nutritional value of like a tomato or, you know,
absolutely.
Because
yeah.
I think one of the things I think markets that could be developing over the next few years would be, you know, as we begin to see, like maybe under this system, this same plant has more nutrition.
Yeah.
So that like certain people can maybe go after those markets,
yeah.
you know?
So that is a big, big focus these okay. next 2 years is
okay.
looking at how the nutritional value of the melons and onions and things that they're growing mm-hmm. more mm-hmm. in the South Texas region,
yes.
how that's
yes.
being influenced.
So you know that Sarah Burnett's dad did his thesis in the 70s on the microbial life in the soil from the plant to the cattle and
oh,
how it
cool.
impacted the meat.
Very
yeah, he was so, so ahead of his time.
Yeah.
Like if he were here right now, of course, you know how people is. You're always a genius
yeah.
90 miles away from home.
yeah, yeah. And so working with them, but then just the industry partnerships we have beyond Mylan, it's interesting to me, so many of the companies that I would consider being hardcore synthetic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know of any company that isn't
now, if there's money to be made, they're
into
gonna,
the
yeah.
biological mm-hmm. world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of them yeah. are focused on, you know, free living nitrogen fixers that are going to pull atmospheric into
yes.
and
yes.
fix nitrogen in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
That way we don't have to add as
and
much
yes,
UAN
right.
or urea to our soil.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be cost-wise, but also just environmental-wise. I mean,
yeah.
that's a big impact.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really, so, you know, carbon markets are huge
yeah.
thing, and everybody is like, you know, convinced. Well, I'm not saying everybody, but there's a lot of people, you know, I don't think it's as big of a deal as it was maybe
yeah.
5 years ago.
Yeah.
But you guys have measured carbon out there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We've measured carbon everywhere. Yes, we have pulled soil samples from South Texas up into Dalhart and the Northern Panhandle. And, you know, based on what we've seen, soil texture, as we were talking about earlier, is a major factor.
Mm-hmm.
Your clay soils are going to be able to protect more carbon. You're going to have mm-hmm. just inherently greater carbon in those soils than you would in your sandy soil. And then management practice. Your crops that produce greater biomass, of course, are going to result in greater carbon inputs into the system. That typically would result in greater sequestration or storage of that carbon in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to me, it's not about how much we have. It's the benefits that we get from adding the carbon to the soil.
Right.
Stimulating microbial cycling,
point.
Microbial activity,
mm-hmm.
And cycling nutrients
mm-hmm.
so that we take mm-hmm. something that might be considered mm-hmm. unavailable and make
right.
it available.
So 11 years ago, when you started, how often do you hear people talk about microbes? Was it something that like soil scientists talked about?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it was involved in everything I did through graduate work from a scientific community. Yes, it's always been a major part of the conversation. Now, when I moved here, I may have heard from a few people that, oh, you don't need to look at the microbes. We don't have any in this environment. It's too dry, you know, but that's not true. I mean, we have microorganisms that are going to be more suited for our dry climates. And as long as we're feeding them, as long as there's carbon or organic material going into the system, they are going to be active. You know, during the colder months, we don't have a whole lot of activity because we can get relatively cold here. Mm-hmm. But microorganisms have always been a major focus.
Yeah. That's interesting. It just seems like, I don't even know. I think back now, I'm like, where did all of this start for
soil
people?
Health? Soil health, the push.
So was it NRCS that said, let's do this? Or was there external factors that make, because generally they're not in the lead, shall we say.
Yeah. So I think there was a big NRCS push, USDA push, towards soil health, and with soil health came this large awareness. Focus. Yes. Yeah. An awareness on the microbial populations and what they were doing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, a lot of the things that we've had these practices, these soil health practices probably since 2015. Mm. But then in the last administration, we started calling them climate smart farming. Yes. We gave them all a different name.
Yeah.
Right. In which now we don't have that name again.
Yeah.
So whiplash. But it's all the same thing.
It's all the same thing.
It's all the same thing.
So before it was soil health, it was conservation practices.
There you go. There you go.
Sustainable ag.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we've had soil tilth, soil quality. Right. The term just changes. But I do, you know, I think in the last 10 to 20 years, there has been a much larger focus that's been put on the biological world.
I think that we have a consumer awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, you know, there was so much emphasis on probiotics even before we started hearing about. Yeah. I wonder sometimes if that push kind of has made people become more aware as they think of food as medicine. Like maybe if I was eating food that was had more microbial life in it, then I wouldn't have to be taking probiotics. You know what I mean? Consumers are just becoming more and more aware.
Yeah.
There's more and more available to them. And as Todd and I have discussed many a time, how do we provide those people with really good and accurate information, you know,
here, what we're doing.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. You know, good example. I was having a conversation with someone probably a year ago. I just spent more energy on hemp than I wish I had about 90% of that energy back and didn't know about 90% of the people that I met.
Yeah.
But one of the things, like, people will just, you know, say, it can do so many things. And I'm like, do you know that 90% of the things that you just mentioned, corn can also make?
Mm-hmm.
No. Yes, it can. You know, and guess what? Yes, it has a lot of cellulose, but cotton has more.
Mm-hmm.
And cotton, it's made cotton. Mm-hmm. You don't have to make it into cotton from hemp. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so being able to, like, come at those conversations to, like, maybe pop some of the bubbles of those myths, I think is really good and important for us to do. And I appreciate y'all coming. This is so interesting.
Yes.
So interesting. So in general, you see benefits of the system as a whole.
Yes.
But when you start piecing it apart without considering your entire system holistically, a holistic look at that system, you know, and so the answer to someone, a consumer who's like, why don't farmers do this? The answer is because it might not be feasible for a multitude of reasons, because it might not work in certain settings the way you're thinking of it.
Absolutely. Yes. Everything has to be managed in a way that's going to be specific to that given environment, that farm even.
Right.
It gets down to the farm level.
Which is one of the reasons why I think it's been, you know, we have an organic certification. Well, that's just pretty much blanket, right? But regenerative, as we're looking at giving these, you know, it's so place-based, you know? And there's so many certifications.
Yeah.
So much time, so much energy on that. When I think maybe the answer is removing all of the people between You know, let's get the consumer and the farmer closer together, or the consumer and that buyer, that brand, mm-hmm. build that relationship so that they can know that they are getting what they're getting, not because a fourth party has certified it, but because they've been on that property and they know that farmer personally.
Mm-hmm. And they know what's best, yes. not only for the longevity of that operation,
yes.
but also environmentally, yes. economically.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Exactly. We think around here about triple bottom line economics, people, planet, profits.
Yep. Absolutely.
And I love that that's really what AgriLife does.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, all of our producers are in this for what I would call the long-term game. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes yeah. that gets lost in mm-hmm. the public.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, they want to be doing that. One, they're doing what they do because they love it.
Yes.
I mean, yes. this is not a get-rich quick scheme at all.
You would not do it. Yes. I mean,
you didn't love it.
When you have to quit, it's like you're pulling it from my cold, dead hands.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
Exactly. Yes. And so that long-term viability yeah. is so important mm-hmm. to them. And maybe that's something we need to do a better job yeah. of letting the public know that, mm-hmm. that, you know, these guys are in this for the long-term. And so yeah. that overall health, as we think mm-hmm. of it, is just as important to them as it is to yeah. you as an right. individual.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it would be a nice thing to even maybe have an economist on and talk about. Let's talk about how much it costs. You know, how much I saw the estimates for cotton this year that were in the red, mm-hmm. not in the black. We're going to make money. We're in the red.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, so, and that is when that's what you've relied on for so many years, suddenly you have to pivot.
Yeah.
All the things that we've discussed.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. one of the funny memes or whatever I saw one time was a grower saying, he said, "I'm not really worried about your $100,000 BMW when I'm sitting in my $750,000 cotton harvester."
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Man, oh my gosh. It yep. is so expensive. It really is. I know there's a group of guys down, I think, in that Tahoka, maybe Dawson County area, that have come together and they're farming cooperatively.
Cool. Yeah.
You know, because yeah. they're like, man, we're going to be able to afford this equipment.
No, the new machines are outrageous.
They are.
Yeah.
They really are. And like we had a discussion earlier on one of the podcast recordings about how much money other countries provide to help their farmers stay in business mm-hmm. versus the 2% of 9% that we get or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's really amazing that that's who our competition is and that we've been able to keep going as long as we have.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
No. And we definitely, you know, we don't realize what, you know, let's say China, for instance, yes. you know, how much they support agriculture and how much they now support agriculture research compared mm-hmm. to what we do.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Todd, that I don't can't remember if we talked about this last month, but the Polish farmers that were here, I asked them what's the things that's most surprising, and they said how far behind you are in innovation.
Yeah.
Well, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
But I did notice that when I was there, like the types of equipment that they have are super high tech, you know, these strip till machines that are like modular, that you can take them apart. You literally like have one plow for your entire year. Mm-hmm. One thing, and it is sensing. It has like 5 sensors so that it's like sensing moisture, depth, where it is. And so it's like moving right to left, up and down to decide where to plant that seed for each individual seed.
It's impressive.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And the EU is paying for half of that so those farmers can get access to that innovation. Yeah. Makes a lot of difference.
Absolutely.
Makes a lot of difference. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, I spent a little bit of time in Europe, and you think, you know, a lot of those farms are much, much smaller.
They are very
from an
small.
Individual standpoint.
They are.
Well, you know, that
20 acres in Poland.
You know, that changes that whole dynamic also.
It does.
And, but the reason they can do that, you know, is because of the support that you're talking
That's
about.
That's exactly
you know,
right.
There, you know, there's yes. no way you could live on 20 acres.
Mm-mm. No. Well, know, and most United of those, States. Most of those, like in Poland, like those farmers are elite. Can you imagine? Imagine having enough land. You say you're at like 500 acres. How many landlords you're dealing with? And a lot of the, some of the, a good part of those subsidy payments go to the landowner and not to the farmer.
Oh.
So it's really an interesting, it's an interesting setup there, you know? Mm, yeah. But imagine if everyone in the United States owned 20 acres. That's what it's like.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Wow. We're just in such, it's so different, you know? It's not different bad, it's just different.
Yeah.
Yes.
You yeah. know, it is. So you have any like big dream research that you want to do?
Oh gosh. Oh. So I think if I could, one, go back in time, but I know that's not possible, so I'll focus on the now. I would really like to establish like the long-term trial that we have down in La Mesa. I would like to establish something like that, but to address the challenges that our farmers are facing now, but have it replicated across these different environments, mm-hmm. like we've been talking about yeah. today. Because again, and maybe that would be that way of demonstrating that what someone in a sandy soil can do and be successful with right. isn't going to be the best right. option for someone right. Lubbock North.
Right.
And so, yeah. you know, establishing something like that where there's going to be 20 plus years of data mm-hmm. That captures mm-hmm. the environmental aspects of it, mm-hmm. the weather that we're experiencing mm-hmm. in a given year, that yeah. that would be my dream
yeah.
is to have that and really be able to communicate broadly the results yes. of something like
yes.
that.
Yes. And you know, I know I have a good friend and he's got family land in Terry County
mm-hmm.
and he's looking for, they're doing fundraising right now. He lives in New York to buy a section of that land to turn it into a research farm.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And then Dolly Baker, Barker has mm-hmm. her place in Morton, mm-hmm. which is amazing. So maybe we'll see some more of that.
Yeah.
You know, this really what we need is we need to be able to see a life size.
Yes.
You know, replica of this and not mm-hmm. just a couple of acres. We yeah. need to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, you know, there's challenges. We've had, Todd and I have had conversations about this, you know, with working on farm, there can be challenges as researchers because we like to do things the same way every single year
oh, yeah, yeah.
so that we can publish those results. And we know farmers aren't going to do that, but that's what makes it interesting about working on farm. And I feel like I'm uh-huh. at a little more stable situation as far as my career goes, that I can take those risks and I yeah. can work more on farm and just start monitoring what's going
thought about,
on.
I really had not thought about that before, about how that is a risky thing for a researcher.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We have to be able to publish.
And yes.
Yes.
Yes. Wow. That is, I have not thought about that.
Well, and even some ways when you're thinking about it from answering a question, you know, if the system changes from year to year, impacted the result?
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, when you're trying to narrow it down to say what weed control do I need to implement
yeah.
or what fertility?
Yes.
You know, when yeah. you're trying to answer yes. single questions and you throw multiple factors from year to year, which they, and we already have the environment doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know. Oh, that's another, there's another one that is going in Lamb County.
Oh,
I forgot about that. Yeah. So there's really some interest in, mm-hmm. in, you know, trying to figure out, you know,
the regional,
impact. A regional thing. Yeah. yeah. And now I'm excited about that because it's a grassroots type of, you know, the same thing that happened in La Mesa. It's like people mm-hmm. saying, you know, we want this to happen.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's exciting. And thank you, friends, for joining us for another episode of Conservation Stories.